Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with House and Senate progressives feeling angry at what some see as a betrayal of Speaker Pelosi's promise not to decouple the already passed Senate infrastructure bill from the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, because of fears progressives have that if the Senate bill is passed, Senators Manchin and Sinema will have no incentive to vote for the larger bill, but will instead start whittling it down. Joining us is Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee at boldprogressives.org, a 1 million member grassroots organization helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. We will discuss the role of a handful of corporate Democrats like Sinema, who took $750,000 from Big Pharma, in preventing the passage of popular programs like reducing the price of prescription drugs and providing dental, vision and hearing care. He argues the House progressives should vote down the Senate bill on Thursday or have Pelosi delay it. Then we'll get an assessment of today's hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, at which the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, the head of CENTCOM, General McKenzie, and the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, testified, facing partisan sniping from Republican senators over the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Joseph Cirincione, a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss Milley's role in defusing a possible nuclear exchange with China, an authorized and necessary move which Republicans complained about. Then finally, we'll go to Hong Kong and speak with Logan Wright, a fellow and the trustee chair in Chinese business and economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as director of China Markets Research at the Rhodium Group. He joins us to discuss the extent to which the real estate giant Evergrande's $300 billion debt, which is heading into default, will impact 30% of China's economy and shave 2 or 3 percentage points of China's GDP. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Adam Green, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a 1 million member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications Director for MoveOn.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Green.
Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a lot of progressive Democrats in the House and in the Senate, too, for that matter, a feeling as though Nancy Pelosi's pulled the rug out from under them, because on a private Democratic caucus meeting on Monday, she told members that she's decoupling the infrastructure bill that the Senate passed because they cannot wait for the Build Back Better Act, the $3.5 trillion bill, which Pelosi's saying needs more time before they can schedule a vote. So I imagine that has to do with Manchin and Sinema, who won't say what they object to in the $3.5 trillion bill. But you've already got Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib saying the move is a betrayal, and she's threatened to vote no on the Thursday vote on the infrastructure bill, along with a number of other progressives. So could this thing really erupt to the point of Democratic fratricide?
I don't think we're going to have Democratic fratricide. I do think Thursday will be a tense moment. I do expect the Progressive Caucus will either vote down this bill or lead to Nancy Pelosi pulling it from the floor. But then I think that that's actually the gateway to all the good things that need to come afterwards. So let's just start with a couple of foundational thoughts. One is that all the good stuff, or most of the good stuff that is the Democratic agenda, that Joe Biden wants to put into law that 2022 frontliners, those at the front lines of keeping the House or winning new seats in the House and Senate, they want to push the Build Back Better $3.5 trillion bill into law. That's childcare and healthcare and jobs and expanding Medicare to cover vision, dental, hearing, many other good things, home care, and of course, climate change protection. The reason that there's such an emphasis on passing that bill and the smaller bipartisan infrastructure bill together is that the right wing or corporate Democrats who are supportive of the bipartisan bill, the second that we pass that, their incentive immediately turns to killing or dramatically watering down all the good stuff in the Build Back Better bill. Right? And that's why there's been this kind of peace in the land for the last couple of months around this mantra of pass both bills together. And it was a real breach of that peace in the land when these corporate aligned Democrats, really doing the bidding of the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, who don't want their member corporations to have to pay any taxes or higher taxes, asked the Josh Gottheimer conservative Democrats of the world to make trouble and try to force a vote on the smaller bill this week. So that pretty much is how we got to where we are. I will be a little bit more generous towards Nancy Pelosi. I think that those corporate Democrats put her in a box about a month ago. She had initially promised a vote on that smaller bill yesterday on Monday. She bought herself a few more days by saying Thursday. But I think that she needs to save face by having that commitment to vote on Thursday. But I think she will also save face if progressives do her the favor of voting down this bill or forcing her to pull it to the floor. That would actually strengthen Nancy Pelosi's hands against Joe Manchin and against the Senate as the real negotiations begin next week.
But Adam, what I don't understand is that if this whole system implodes or the fratricide gets to the point of paralysis, the people who will suffer in the 2022 midterms are these very, what you describe as corporate Democrats, because they're in the swing districts. The Democrats in the safe districts won't be turfed out of office, but it's already going to be hard to win in 2022, given the comprehensive and massive Republican voter suppression. So if the Democrats come up empty, they're going to get swamped in this election. And these so-called corporate Democrats will be the first victims, won't they?
Some of them will be. I do want to, again, I don't think there's fratricide around the corner. I think that Thursday will be a tense moment. It will likely result in progressives winning. And that means keeping this as a two-bill process. But really, the corporate Democrats, the more conservative Democrats, have no real incentive to leave the table because they want to pass the bipartisan bill that's already passed the Senate. You know, and that's still an option to pass it later in the House. The only question is, do they deal in good faith as we try to get as close to the $3.5 trillion bill as possible to do things like childcare, healthcare, jobs, climate change? I also wanted, I'm actually penning an op-ed right now that I guess I'll preview for you, which is called Don't Call Them Moderates. And a point that I'm making in it is that these 10 obstructionist House Democrats are actually not the Democrats most at risk of losing their seats. They're almost taking the mantle of being these swing district Democrats when many of them actually represent very Democratic districts. They just happen to have won primaries, unfortunately backed by corporate interests, and are way more conservative than their district. So to give a few examples, Josh Gottheimer, who's the ringleader of the pack, he won his last race by 7.6% and was not even on the Cook Political Report's list of most competitive districts last cycle. Representative Ed Case in Hawaii won his district by a whopping 44%. He didn't win 44%, he won by 44%. Jim Costa of California won by 18.8%. All the way down the line, 13%, 12%, 12%. So that's why it's just weird that this is the crew holding up the works. Those who won by 1%, 2%, 3%, they're on board for the Build Back Better bill because they know that running on things like expanding healthcare or dental vision hearing for seniors in their district is very popular. That having more jobs and higher paying jobs is very popular. That having home care and child care is very popular. And people who are like from Texas or Florida, they know we have to deal with climate change. So a weird irony here is that this is not moderation. This is not, people who are in political peril, who are just sticking out, looking out for their own political interests. This is corruption, pure and simple. These are people who are doing the bidding of the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce, who simply don't like the pay-fors in this bill. This is a fully paid-for bill. It would not add a dollar to the deficit. And that's because billionaires would finally pay their fair share. Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk. And also, as Joe Biden pointed out this past week, there are, 50 or more giant corporations in America that pay zero in taxes, and they would finally have to pay their taxes. Well, those entities fund the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce. So again, this is really 95% of the Democratic Party versus the most corrupt 5%, and hopefully we'll win it at the end of the day.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Green, who is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a 1 million member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications Director for MoveOn.org. So is that to say then, Adam, that this is kind of plan B for the establishment in the sense they already, the Chamber of Commerce already have the Republican Party, so if they can peel off just a handful of Democrats, they can stymie any progressive legislation?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And, The Intercept has done great reporting with leaks of memos and phone calls from the Business Roundtable, where they're almost giddy to heap praise on just a couple of obstructionist Democrats, folks like Kristen Sinema, folks like Josh Gottheimer, who they fund. There was a report last week that Kristen Sinema got $750,000 from Big Pharma, as corporate Democrats try to remove the provisions of this bill to allow Medicare to negotiate hundreds of billions of savings for Americans in prescription drug prices, right? They're giddy that they have just a couple complicit Democrats who are willing to go along. But again, I think that the moment of truth is this Thursday. If progressives stand their ground, which I think they will, hold the line and allow us to fight to another day with both bills on track, not just the one where we have no leverage, I think we will actually have a pretty good outcome in a couple weeks.
But what I don't understand then is already apparently progressives in Arizona are furious at Sinema and Gottheimer in New Jersey. Can't they be primaried? If they tank the Democratic agenda, if they tank Biden's agenda, won't they be pilloried?
I certainly hope so, and I do think that would be true of Kristen Sinema. This past week, some great organizing in Arizona led to the Democratic Party of Arizona passing a resolution saying that if she does not get rid of the filibuster for voting rights, which is pretty critical to saving our entire democracy at this point, that they will have a vote of no confidence in her. And what that basically means is that she'll be primaried in a couple of years. I will point out to your listeners that groups like ours, boldprogressives.org, and others, Working Families Party, Move On, you name it, we are constantly supporting primary candidates. Many of them are in open seat primaries where there's no incumbent running and there's a competition between a corporate aligned Democrat and a progressive. But every once in a while, we also primary an incumbent. And I know that among some people, it's like, oh, why are you primarying Democrats? We don't have time for that. I'll just support the person in the general election. I'm not going to pay attention right now. Well, if you're outraged that voting rights are hanging by a thread and we'll be doomed if we don't pass something, if you're mad that Democrats, quote unquote, like Josh Gottheimer and Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin holding up the works on this giant economic proposal that even moderates like Joe Biden supports, well, let this be a reminder of how important primaries are. Because Josh Gottheimer, the person who's leading the fight in the House to obstruct the bill, he faced an amazing progressive woman of color, city councilwoman named Arati Krajbich last cycle, and she lost. She did well, but she lost. And if there had been more support for her, maybe we wouldn't be in this mess, right? Kristen Sinema didn't have to be the nominee, but she is. And there's other examples of that where some of the, the person in Hawaii who won by 44 points, he had a progressive primary challenger, but there wasn't enough support for him. So we really need to pay attention to primaries and remember this moment, not let it be forgotten.
Right. But surely we don't want this moment to happen, do we? I mean, you don't want Biden to fail with the massive voter suppression that they'll employ in 2022. They'll already pick up the House, the Republicans, through gerrymandering alone before a vote is cast. Unless you deal with the voter suppression, as you pointed out earlier, it's just political suicide on the part of the Democrats. So the point is that this moment cannot happen. The idea of getting revenge against these people, while it may well be necessary, in fact, it clearly is, the real issue is saving the Democratic agenda, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our organization made a concerted decision in about February or March of this year that as much as we do election stuff, our top priorities for the next, 6, 8 months, we said will be voting rights and this Build Back Better agenda, because nothing will matter in the 2022 elections if people can't vote and if they're not motivated to vote, right? Democrats need to deliver now that we have power. So I completely agree with you. We need to get this done, and that's why, 95% of the Democratic Party is there. We need to get across the finish line. I just do want to underscore one point, though. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer do have very difficult dances when it comes to getting the final couple people across the finish line. On the filibuster front, when it comes to voting rights, Chuck Schumer has basically made a gambit. He's made a decision to give Joe Manchin first pride in ownership in this new bill called the Freedom to Vote Act that Manchin and John Tester from Montana, but also Reverend Warnock and some other good progressives like Jeff Merkley, were instrumental in writing. It has probably 70, 75% of what was in the For the People Act, and it has the most important stuff on voting rights and gerrymandering and others. So he's now fully on board behind this proposal, and Schumer has given him a couple more weeks, Joe Manchin, to negotiate with Republicans. Even though most of us think there is 0% chance that there will be a single Republican on board, he's going along, giving him a little bit of a graceful couple weeks to try, so that hopefully, if this gambit proves successful, we reform the filibuster in a couple of weeks. I think similarly, that's what Nancy Pelosi is doing this week by scheduling the vote on Thursday. I'm hoping that it's not an outright betrayal. I'm hoping this is her way of saying to the corporate Democrats who put her in a weird position a month ago and made her promise a vote this week, "Hey, I'm trying. I scheduled the vote, but darn it, we don't have the vote. So now we have to go to a plan B. We have to deal with these crazy progressives and actually negotiate these two bills in tandem." But again, I think that Nancy Pelosi's hand actually becomes way stronger for all the things that she and 95% of House Democrats want if we get past Thursday and progressives are successful in blocking the smaller bill from going down and keeping progressive leverage at the table. So we'll see. We'll see if these gambits pay off. If we don't pass voting rights, if we don't pass the Build Back Better agenda, we're in a pretty bad position going into 2022.
Well, Adam Green, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And again, I hope your listeners go to boldprogressives.org and join the fight.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Adam Green, who's a co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a 1 million-member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications Director for MoveOn.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of today's hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, in which Republicans complained about General Milley's role in defusing a possible nuclear exchange with China.
I'm fixing broken things. I am fixing broken things. Things are mended, things are glued, and I have best I can do. I'm fixing broken things.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, who's a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute and a national security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author or editor of seven books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. And he previously worked for over 9 years on this professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the United States House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Joe, you're pretty familiar with testimonies before the Armed Services Committee. And today, before the Senate Armed Services Committee, General Milley and Lloyd Austin and General McKenzie, the head of CENTCOM, testified. And frankly, I mean, obviously, I couldn't watch all of it because I'm busy, but what I saw sort of irritated me in many ways, because the military people and Austin, of course, is a former general, seem sort of sober, professional, straightforward, very credible. And yet these Republican senators were just yapping like junkyard dogs, in asking stupid political questions and just trying to score points. I mean, is that what it's become? Was it any better in your day?
It was better in my day. So I worked on the House Armed Services Committee in the 1980s and into the 1990s. And we thought there was a lot of partisan warfare then, but it pales in comparison to what you're seeing now. I mean, this is an extremely serious subject. The failure of the 20-year Afghanistan war, the chaotic withdrawal, issues around the role of the chairman in the nuclear launch procedures, very serious subjects. And at least half of the Senate Armed Services Committee is treating this as a gotcha moment. They keep looking for that soundbite that they can use to attack President Biden. And I must say, I didn't think the Democratic members, with a couple of exceptions like Elizabeth Warren and Tim Kaine, were distinguishing themselves all that well either.
So one of the examples, of course, is Senator Tom Cotton going after Milley and saying that he should have resigned. And Milley, of course, pointed out to him that the Marines that were killed at the airport in Kabul, they didn't have the option of resigning. You know, you don't walk away just like a sheriff tearing off his badge in the middle of your duty. I mean, I thought Milley swatted him down pretty effectively. What did you think?
Oh, I thought so, too. And you can see Tom Cotton just didn't have an answer to that. That's what, you know, they're looking to get primarily President Biden in this, but secondarily, they're trying to get Milley, and they're trying to go after him for talking to reporters or disclosing information. Or, you know, if you felt so strongly about this, why didn't you just resign? And of course, Milley was placed in an impossible situation. What is he supposed to do on that most moments after January 6th, where he's concerned that a crazy president might launch us into a war with China that could go nuclear or directly start a nuclear war. Resigning is the last thing you would do, because then you would just be handing off the problem to someone else, and you would be eliminating your possibility of mediating that kind of crisis. I thought Milley acquitted himself well, both in the moment, what he did in January and the way he did it, and then at the hearing today, explaining his decision, including the memorandum that he provided the committee to explain his role in the command authority procedures.
And that came about because of 2 days after the storming of the Capitol on January the 8th, Speaker Pelosi called Milley and was concerned about the mental state of Donald Trump and asked him a bunch of probing questions about the chain of command and the launch authority. And of course, the Republicans were demagoguing all of that about that call and suggesting that somehow other Milley was being an amateur psychiatrist trying to diagnose Trump's mental state. But in fact, it was Pelosi who I think is pretty aware of Trump and his mental state. But the point about that whole thing was it's about perceptions, about how other nuclear powers see us. And we had back in 1983, in November of 1983, the 1983 war scare, where the geriatrics on kidney dialysis in the Kremlin were convinced themselves that Reagan meant it when he said the Soviet Union was going to end up on the ash heap of history. And they misinterpreted a NATO exercise, Able Archer 83, and moved to launch a preemptive strike based upon their perceptions. Now, it turns out that the Chinese had similar perceptions that somehow the Americans, under this crazy president, who they were totally well aware of, particularly Xi Jinping, is aware of who Trump is and how he behaves, they were worried too. So this was a very serious situation, was it not?
Oh, I completely agree. And we now have the lesson of Able Archer, you know, where we came very close to a nuclear war. As you say, the Soviets were convinced that the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan at that time was now being matched by this massive military exercise in Europe that they thought was a cover for a military mobilization. And this is, under certain scenarios, this is in fact how you would do such a thing. And Reagan was completely unaware of that at the time. We escaped that journey to the brink of nuclear disaster by the wise decisions of some low-level officers in the Soviet Union at that time. But when Reagan found out about it later, he was stunned. He had no idea that the Soviets would think this. In fact, it's one of the things that led him to negotiate with Gorbachev a few years later to try to eliminate nuclear weapons, to make sure this would never happen again. And so Milley, being aware of this, is understandably concerned when he sees our intelligence that the Chinese believe that Trump might be doing a similar action, might be getting ready to attack China. So he does the responsible thing, the action that is well within his authority to do, to call up his Chinese counterpart, as he has in the past, but this time with urgent messages that we are not preparing to attack. Everything's under control, lying a bit, because this was after January 6th and things were not under control. And that if, in fact, we're getting to the point where we're contemplating military action against China, he, Milley, will call the Chinese and talk to them about this. That was the proper thing to do. It diffused what could otherwise have been a very dangerous moment.
And it was cleared by the White House and by the Secretary of Defense.
Yes, and none of this is secret. So when we say a phone call, it's not like, well, it's not even like this, me calling you with a couple of staff on the phone. No, this is an interagency operation. There were, my understanding, well over a dozen people on this phone call. So it's something that's happened transparently. It's not being done in secret. Everyone is aware of what's going on.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cernicioni, a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute and a national security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author or editor of 7 books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. And he previously worked for over 9 years on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the United States House of Representatives. So, just to touch on this call with Pelosi on January the 8th, after that call, Milley sat down with his staff and they went over the nuclear launch procedures. And is that the memo that you're talking about, Joe?
Yes. So as part of his testimony, General Milley submitted a memo for the record about his call with Pelosi to the committee, and it's now available publicly today.
So did you think that there was any, in terms of the Republicans trying to score points, was there any distance that the generals and the Secretary of Defense were in their testimony between what Biden had said that the generals approved of the withdrawal? Because clearly they made it clear that they had lots of questions and they weren't in favor of it. And we can certainly talk about what they said, but was there any distance between them? Between the president and his top military advisors?
Well, you will see headlines in the next couple of days that the general said that they were in favor of keeping 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And President Biden has said no military commander recommended that we keep 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. So there is a disconnect there. And I think it may be talking about different time frames. That was definitely the position of the Joint Chiefs, including Milley, and they testified to that today, that they wanted to keep troops there. The president overruled them. I think Biden might be talking about August, that by the time this all unfolds in August, and even when Kabul falls, he asked the chiefs about extending the presence. And apparently at that time, nobody recommended extending the presence. Nobody recommended staying past August 31st. But that's the closest you came to a disconnect between what the generals are saying and what Biden is saying.
But the U.S. didn't have the option of staying past August the 31st. That was the deal with the Taliban, and the Taliban said, if you guys aren't out by that time, we'll open fire on you.
Oh, that's exactly right. And then you hear the generals today testifying to that. And Elizabeth Warren teased it out even a little further. So she said, you're saying she's asking Secretary Austin and General Milley, you're saying you would have favored keeping those troops in Afghanistan, but that would have meant keeping them there indefinitely. Is that right? And they both said, yes, that's right. That you couldn't just keep them there for a little bit of time, because they said if we kept them there after the 31st, the Taliban would definitely have attacked at that point, and we might be in the position of requiring reinforcements. So that is the situation President Biden was facing. He understood what the military preferred to do, but he wanted out. He couldn't see that keeping them there any longer was going to make any difference in the eventual outcome. And when he specifically asked generals about this, would keeping them there, say, at that level, save the Afghan government? The best they could come up with was for a while, but it was not a solution to the problem.
So I don't know that Trump supporters, the 30% of the country that support him, and after all, most of the Republican Party, something close to 80%, believe that Trump won the election and that Biden is an imposter and an interloper. And frankly, for the life of me, I do not understand why anybody in this country, after the absolutely incompetent and reckless way Trump handled COVID with close to 700,000 dead Americans, his absolute ridiculous, pathetic amateurism in foreign policy, where he kept getting rolled by everybody from Erdogan to Putin, and clearly got rolled by the Taliban. And this Doha agreement that he did was so idiotic. And he even wanted to have the Taliban come to Camp David, for God's sake. And this is what the generals at least got an opportunity to talk about, how, you know, you're trying to blame Biden for the collapse of the Afghan army. Well, the Doha agreement was why they collapsed, because Trump made this amazingly stupid agreement with them, which said, you, the Taliban, can kill as many of the army as you like. Just don't touch an American. And we're getting out, by the way.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And you heard that kind of testimony today. And the Democrats did a good job of this, of clarifying that the generals told President Trump that they would prefer to keep 2,500, 3,500 troops there. And Trump also rejected that option, and that Trump wanted them all gone by January of 2021. After the election, Trump ordered that the troops leave in January. Very interesting. And eventually the generals got him to back off of that. But this was not simply a matter of Biden overruling what the generals wanted to do. They had a similar situation with Donald Trump, which of course undercuts the Republican argument that it was somehow President Biden that stabbed the military in the back. No, this was both Biden and President Trump who wanted to end the war, both of them. And of course, that decision is overwhelmingly supported by the American people. Over 70, 75% of the American people support the decision to leave Afghanistan, even after the chaos of the withdrawal in the last couple of weeks of August.
The one disappointment I had with what I watched, Joe, was, I can't remember which Democratic senator it was, asked a question about Pakistan, and we know Pakistan plays a key role. And in fact, the head of the CIA, Burns, recently went with the head of the ISI to meet with the Taliban, but also the head of the ISI, the Pakistani military intelligence, he apparently sort of broke up a fight between the Haqqani faction and Baradar, the diplomatic faction, if you will, the ones that negotiated in Doha with Trump's emissary. Mm-hmm. So the question was about Pakistan's role, and boy, that is something that we need to learn about. And now, because, you know, Pakistan's got what they wanted, a Taliban victory. And now whether they'll have buyer's remorse remains to be seen. But I guess the question was deflected by saying we have to talk about that in close session. So when do you think, or will we ever get some clarity on the extent to which Pakistan stabbed us in the back?
I don't think we're going to get that through the congressional process. I mean, if you watch these hearings, one of the takeaways is the Senate Armed Services Committee is broken as an oversight arm. Remember, this is the same committee that funded the war in Afghanistan for 20 years and never had a serious hearing on the war in Afghanistan. You know, they could have had a hearing like this last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. They never did. They could have had a hearing after the Doha agreement. They did not. And so you cannot depend on the Senate Armed Services Committee, who was complicit in this failure, you know, who authorized all these troop deployments, who authorized the contracts for this, who was supposed to be overseeing the training of the Afghan forces and failed miserably. So they have no interest in exploring this. And that's what you're seeing in these hearings. Not only are the Republicans not asking questions about what went wrong over the last 20 years, but most of the Democrats aren't either, including the chairman, Jack Reed. So if you want to learn the lessons of the Afghan war, it's not going to be through the U.S. Congress. They're too complicit in the failure to be counted on to be able to launch an objective investigation. So I don't think we're going to get many more hearings on Afghanistan after today's.
And just in terms of the sort of snide, sniping, partisan idiocy coming from the Republicans, you mentioned that effective testimony or questions by Senator Warren. When she finished, Republican Sullivan, I think he was, who followed her, sort of made some snide remark about her gutting the military. My God, they just added, you know, in fact, the three Democrats joined in on the...
$25 billion. The Senate Armed Services Committee just last month added $25 billion to President Biden's request, and the entire committee voted in favor of it except for Elizabeth Warren.
And we're talking about a defense budget. Talk about gutting the military. Isn't it the biggest defense budget in history?
Yes. Yes. In absolute terms, it is. It's the big since World War II. This is the biggest defense budget we've had in World War II. And even adjusted for inflation, there were only a couple of years right after the invasion of Iraq where the budget was bigger. So now we have almost a $780 billion budget for the Pentagon and the Department of Energy while we're withdrawing from Afghanistan, while we're ending one of our major wars, while we're supposed to be curtailing combat operations, the military budget keeps growing.
Well, Joe Cirincione, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute and a national security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author or editor of seven books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. And he previously worked for over 9 years on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the United States House of Representatives. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the real estate giant Evergrande's $300 billion debt is heading into default and how much it will impact China's economy and reduce China's GDP. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Hong Kong is Logan Wright, a fellow and the trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as the director of China Markets Research at the Rhodium Group, where he focuses on the impact of credit expansion on the Chinese financial system, China's exchange rates policies, and the influence of the country on global currency and capital markets. And he's based in Hong Kong after living and working in Beijing for 14 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Logan Wright.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Evergrande's $300 billion debt has got obviously a lot of people concerned, and they did miss a payment, an $83.5 million interest payment, which is due last Thursday, but that affected foreign investors. So let's begin with that. Is there a sort of different standard here with, as far as the Chinese government in whatever they might do to bail out or stop any kind of contagion with Evergrande? Would they take care of it onshore and then let the offshore chips fall as they may?
That is a concern, I think, in the markets right now. I don't think historically there has been sort of differential treatment for onshore and offshore investors, but it's really unclear whether that is going to happen in this case. In one sense, It's not really the bond investors or the magnitude of the debt in the bond market. That's the immediate forcing event. It's what markets are focused on, but it's not that large relative to Evergrande's other liabilities in the onshore market. I mean, their far greater debt burden is actually to homeowners who need to have their homes finished, that they've already bought them pre-construction, but they have not been delivered yet. And there's greater, and there's concern about suppliers and contractors. I mean, I think that is where the firm's real, more fundamental, the larger size of their debt burdens are. On this onshore, offshore payment, there's, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information about what exactly has happened. In any case, it doesn't look like they've paid the interest conventionally through the bond clearinghouse. And so they have up to 30 days before it's formally declared in default, according to the local regulations. But in that sense, it is a growing concern that the longer that this goes on without a clear source of support from Beijing for the company, there's, you know, a greater probability that you could have, you know, more disorderly outcomes with more and more of the firms that are owed money by Evergrande trying to redeem those claims. And that increases pressure on the company as well.
So apparently about $20 billion of the $300 billion of Evergrande's debt is held by foreign investors. Is that right?
Yes, that's roughly about right, based on the data we've seen as well.
So, but the real issue in terms of China's economy is that the real estate sector of the Chinese economy is about, what, 30% of its GDP?
Yes, at least a quarter by most estimates. I mean, no one really knows, but the you know, a reasonable range of estimates, depending upon how much you want to project into construction materials and other upstream and downstream industries or things like that, is somewhere between, you know, 14 and 29% or sort of the range of estimates that are out there in the literature. No matter what, it is, you know, clearly China's most important industry and has contributed arguably the most to its economic growth over the last decade.
And Evergrande Group is, what, one of the largest property developers in the world, let alone in China. And it's clearly the most indebted, right?
That's right. It is the largest in China. It has over 300, based on the June disclosures, around $305 billion in liabilities, which is just a massive number, no matter how you think about it. But what's notable is that Evergrande's exceptional, you know, because of its size, but it's not really exceptional because of its financing tactics or its methods. And so that's really the concern that we have, which is that, you know, it is not the only developer in difficulty at this point. It's not the only developer to have defaulted already. And Evergrande hasn't formally defaulted yet, but just to clarify. But there are other developers who have already defaulted earlier this year on their debt. Other developers are already scaling back construction more aggressively. And basically what we're seeing is the end of a certain model of property-funded growth that used to depend upon speculative investment and investment-driven purchases in China's property sector, and is now, you know, very dependent upon financing from pre-construction sales. So a dynamic where people are willing to put down 100% of the purchase price before they actually receive the apartment itself. And you're only really willing to do that in most markets if you think that the price is going to rise and continue to, you know, pay mortgages on a property well before you receive it, if you expect that the prices would continue rising. The overall market has become far more speculative. What Beijing has done is they've put new restrictions on how developers can, how much interest-bearing debt developers can borrow from the market based on certain financial ratios, the so-called three red lines. So that's really changed the game, because in the past, if you needed to keep expanding construction through this model of sales, you would always be fine as long as you had access to an ever-growing pool of finance. That is, when you don't have access to those financial channels, it forces harder choices on developers. And in many ways, Beijing's actions to try to rein in the property sector are contributing to the slowdown in construction growth, the difficulties in developers in maintaining the current pace of activity. And that has really been a precipitating event for much of the many of the struggles that Evergrande specifically has had, but have also occurred among other developers as well. The other issue to keep in mind is that financial markets are taking these signals far more seriously from Beijing. If you know that Beijing is actually committed to reducing the imprint of the property market within the economy over time, and this is a 10-year battle that they've been waging against speculation in the property market, you know, perhaps in the past you would have thought, well, they'll ultimately back away when push comes to shove. They'll ultimately back away when the economy really starts slowing because the property market is so important. But after the actions against some of the high-tech firms over the summer, some of the ride-hailing education and tutoring firms over the summer, investors are looking at the way Beijing is reacting and saying, you know, perhaps they're less concerned about the economic outcomes of some of these decisions. Perhaps these are being made for more political reasons. And that leads to a lot more caution about investing in these companies, the property developers, Evergrande and others, and in buying their bonds as well.
And again, joining us from Hong Kong is Logan Wright, a fellow and the trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as the director of China Markets Research at the Rhodium Group, where he focuses on the impact of credit expansion on the Chinese financial system, China's exchange rate policies, and the influence of the country on global currency and capital markets. And he's based in Hong Kong after having lived in Beijing for 14 years. So some of these other companies that have been broken up and failed, like Anbang and H&A and Dalian Wanda, how do they compare in size to Evergrande and the other real estate companies that you say that may not be in equal trouble, but they're certainly in some kind of trouble? So give us a perspective on what's happened prior and what could happen in the future.
Sure. Very different treatments of all of those firms, some of which have not necessarily been broken up or just been regulated slightly more harshly. But in the case of, you know, H&A or Anbang, you know, Anbang was involved. There have been, you know, criminal cases involving its founders. So it's a very sort of exceptional dynamic itself. For H&A, it's more of a purely financial conglomerate. So it becomes easier to, I mean, still very complex, but it becomes easier to sort of separate out the assets and potentially, you know, sell them off in the event of the needs to do so in a restructuring. Evergrande is a bit more interconnected. There's thousands of suppliers and contractors involved, and that's what makes it so complex. And all of those contractors, suppliers, and home buyers are going to be reacting to what Beijing's choices are. So for Beijing's options, they're interesting because you could choose to basically only privilege the claims of the home buyers and the contractors who are owed money and basically impose losses on the investors and shareholders. But that would clearly drive a broader credit crunch across the sector, and banks would be less willing to lend to property developers. And then it becomes a question of, well, if you don't want to impose a complete haircut, how much of a haircut should you design? And that's a very complicated question and will likely take time and becomes costly because the resources for such a restructuring have to come from somewhere. And so those are, I think, the questions that they are pondering right now. The issue is not only the interconnectedness and the vast reach of Evergrande as a firm. The issue is the implications that it will have for other property developers in China and the impact that will have on the broader market. Because the broader market right now is weakening, you know, fairly substantially. And I think that's the most important thing from our perspective is what happens to the overall pace of property sales after any resolution or, you know, or orderly or disorderly workout of Evergrande occurs. Sales have been down 8% in July nationwide, 16% in August, And so far in September, you know, you don't have a full data yet, but based on the partial data from 30 major cities, we're down a bit over 30% so far. This is the most significant adjustment in China's property market since 2014. And at that time, you had a pretty significant slowdown in the economy, weakness in China's imports, weakness in commodity demand, and an impact on global cyclical indicators as well. So those are the sort of signals we're watching for right now.
Well, already it seems that the Chinese government is preparing to crack down on the demonstrations. There were demonstrations by home buyers who, as you point out, they put their money up before they've got their apartments or homes, and they're terrified. And they're also, it's a small investors who may not be that sophisticated, given that the Chinese stock exchanges hasn't been around that long. But there have already been some number of demonstrations. So they're being proactive in basically essentially telling people not to protest, which is not exactly containing the problem, but containing the optics, I guess. But in 2017, when he began his second term, Xi Jinping, he mentioned that reining in financial risk was going to be one of the great battles of his tenure, his second term. Is there a sense, though, amongst these high rollers like Evergrande, that at the end of the day, the central bank's always going to bail you out? Has that given them a little bit of too much of a comfort factor that they've pushed the envelope?
I think you have hit the critical issue in China's financial system. You know, you've hit the nail right on the head, which is that it is this perception that government will step in and provide a credible and meaningful response to financial stress that has in many ways provided the critical source of stability in China's financial system over the past 10 years or more. So if you know that ultimately, even if there is financial stress that's likely to arise, that there's going to be a meaningful government response, you don't have to wait for it. You don't have to remain uncertain about who is actually going to be bailed out. If you think that ultimately that safety net is there, then you're more likely to take more risk. And so in the past, when we have seen instances of financial stress in China, we have seen the result of those instances being a flight to risk rather than a flight to quality. So in other words, if you thought that in June 2013, for example, that banks were willing to offer you very high interest rates because their funding costs had risen, you know, ordinarily in a market-driven system, you would view that as a risky bank. You would say, well, you know, maybe I'm willing to offer this bank, a deposit-like return. Maybe I'm willing to offer this bank money for a deposit-like return at something over 10%. But do you really want to invest in a bank like that, given that they're willing to offer you a rate at that level? In China, historically, the answer was yes, because there was confidence that the government was going to step in and support the banking system. But that is an unsustainable dynamic as the system gets larger, more complex, and riskier. And one of the most interesting episodes occurred in August 2018, when there were about 10,000 people, several thousand people, we don't really know exactly how many, who showed up in Beijing to protest losses against peer-to-peer lending products that had blown up. And Beijing had, you know, waged a pretty concerted effort to try to regulate the peer-to-peer lending industry and to try to reduce the potential risks that would result. And naturally, some of these products defaulted and some of these investors were angry. And so they showed up collectively. But I think this was the interesting thing, is that many people commenting on that said, well, what did you expect? Why did you think that, you know, you were all noticed in terms of you showed up in Beijing and protested? You know, why did you think that you were going to get away with that? And I think what that was missing was the whole point was to be noticed. The whole point of that protest was to be as collective and large as possible in order to force Beijing to take this seriously, because every other instance in the past they had done so. And that had actually produced a meaningful sort of compensation offer. And so that was the dynamic that is changing now. That protest was unsuccessful around the time of the deleveraging campaign was entering the campaign you discussed that she launched in around late 2016, early 2017 to clean up financial risk in the system. And now you can no longer be certain that the government is actually going to step in. So we wrote an entire book about this with CSIS called Credit and Credibility, which was reinforcing this argument that it was the system is most vulnerable when Beijing's credibility is changing, when you can no longer be certain about the guarantees, the backstops for new groups of assets. And that's really what I think is propelling the current market dynamics around Evergrande forward. It's the fact that we're no longer sure exactly how far Beijing will push the property sector. Investors cannot be certain of that. Therefore, they are protecting themselves by de-risking rather than waiting for the government to protect them and waiting for a bailout. And so that's why you have suddenly a significant selling pressure on Chinese debt and on the equities of property developers as well.
So just in closing then, Logan, it seems like Xi Jinping is trying to navigate between sort of teaching these high rollers a lesson and sending a signal to investors and Chinese companies not to get into too much risk, at the same time being aware of the consequences of the whole situation unraveling 30% of the economy and a Lehman Brothers moment, as a lot of analysts have suggested, could be on the horizon. So is that what he's trying to do?
Yeah, I think in terms of the analogies to financial and the analogies to other financial panics, I think it just sort of shows you how much the conversation has already changed, that we're already talking about, you know, just the level of financial stress, regardless of whether this is, you know, a Lehman moment or a comparison to some other crisis. It just shows you that we're talking about a different level of economic growth in China and whether there's going to be, you know, a short-term slowdown in growth, a longer-term slowdown in growth, or some greater financial stress. And regarding that dilemma, that is exactly, it's a very difficult question, and it's perhaps unknowable. You can't necessarily know when the real pricing of credit risk in markets carries over into broader contagion. If we can all agree that this institution is distressed and needs support, because if it doesn't have support, it'll have systemic consequences, that's an easy problem to address. You deploy the central bank to inject liquidity to and somehow provide funding to that institution. What we're dealing with now is the fact that you actually want some of these institutions to be protecting themselves, to be pricing credit risk better. And you can't be sure exactly when that process carries over into broader contagion in the market. So that's the very delicate balancing act that we're watching unfold right now.
So just in the last minute, what's your prediction of the direction of the Chinese economy, up or down, slow or steady?
Sure. I think the most likely scenario at this point, based on the trends we're seeing in the property market, is a pretty meaningful slowdown in property construction, so weaker economic growth. And then the financial components, it'll be difficult. It'll be interesting to see what Beijing does next, because those actions are really critical in minimizing the corresponding financial stress. But if you do have broader stress on credit markets and on the banking system, then that could exacerbate the slowdown as well. But I think we are talking about transitioning from a Chinese economy with potential growth in the 5 to 5.5% range over the next decade into something a few percentage points lower.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Logan Wright.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Logan Wright, who's a fellow and the trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as the director of China Markets Research at the Rhodium Group, where he focuses on the impact of credit expansion on the Chinese financial system, China's exchange rates policies, and the influence of the country on global currency and capital markets. And he's based in Hong Kong after having lived and worked in Beijing for 14 years, and he joined us from Hong Kong. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.